Well, good morning. We're going to talk about a very fascinating person. In my mind, probably one of the greatest, maybe not the greatest, but certainly one of the greatest attorneys of the 19th century. And he is a remarkable figure in many, many respects, and he's not somebody I had ever heard of before. I ended up hearing about him quite by accident, just slightly over a year ago. I acquired two original letters written by Alexander Campbell, and they were written to Judge Jeremiah Black. And the letters were very long letters. One was 3 pages, the other was 4 pages, handwritten letters. So this kind of led to my interest in Judge Black, and Sam and I and some of the other folks here were talking last year about what to do this year. We thought, well, how about talking about Judge Jeremiah Black? Well, when I agreed to do that, I had no idea that he was going to be such an interesting person and such an influential person. He was born at his father's homestead, a place called Pleasant Glades in Stony Creek Township, Somerset County, Pennsylvania. His grandfather was James Black, a man of considerable landed property. He was a farmer and justice of the peace. And his father, Henry Black, was also Justice of the Peace, Associate Judge of the County for 20 years, and a member of the General Assembly, and he was elected to the United States Congress, but shortly after his election, he passed away in 1841. Jeremiah Black attended the schools of the neighborhood, but he was keenly interested in Shakespeare, the Latin classics, and at age 15, he committed the text of Horace to memory verbatim and translated it into English prose and then turned it into an English poem of his own creation. It's said till the very day of his death that he could quote all 3 versions of Horace verbatim. He had 4 great literary influences. These 4 he considered exemplars or models of the style that he sought to demonstrate. And they were Horace, Milton, Shakespeare, and the Bible. And he read them all vociferously, and he memorized what was in the text constantly. And at this point in his life, he didn't really have an interest in the Bible in terms of spiritual transformation. To him, the Bible was literature. And it was a world in which everyone read the Bible, and that meant the King James Version of the Bible, which of course tied in very nicely with Shakespeare. And if you think about the kind of meter that you find in both Shakespeare and the King James Version of the Bible, there's a great similarity. It's also a time in which every educated person could read Latin, and quite often they would read things like the commentaries of Caesar in Latin. Caesar was one of the first great PR men and historians, similar to Winston Churchill, who discovered that if you write your own history, it's a little kinder to you than if somebody else writes it. So he had that ability. Jeremiah Black did not enjoy farming at all, didn't really care for manual work. His father chided him a little gently about that fact, but he was what he was, and at the age of 17, he became a student in the law office of Chauncey Forward. Back in those days, you didn't go to law school. I've sometimes thought as a member of the bar that law school is perhaps one of the single greatest wastes of time that I ever spent a number of years attending, because it's taught by people who, many of whom haven't actually practiced law in years, many of whom don't know much about what they're talking about, and they try to teach using the Socratic method of teaching, which works quite well in a very small group of people, doesn't work so well in a large group, because you get called upon, and then you know you're not going to be called upon for the next 6 to 8 weeks, and so some people, not me of course, but some people tend to check out mentally. Well, maybe me a little bit. In those days, you read the law. You actually studied law with somebody who was in the active practice of law. And so you learn by doing until you felt ready to sit for the bar exam. Judge Black sat for the bar exam at the age of 19 and passed the bar exam without any real difficulty. Chauncey Forward was a distinguished attorney, and he was a leader of the Democratic Party. Jeremiah's father was a Whig. Nevertheless, Jeremiah was soon a staunch Democrat and would be a staunch Democrat for the rest of his life. He was asked on one occasion if he would ever consider moving to the Republican Party, and he has some very good friends in the Republican Party, including James Garfield. And Black's reply was he would be happy to move to the Republican Party except for the fact that he said, "I believe in hell." And so, based upon that belief, he wasn't going to be converting to the Republican Party. His mind was described as mighty and eager in its grasp. He read everything he could get his hands on. His grandfather, Patrick Sullivan, who had immigrated from Ireland and had actually been born on St. Patrick's Day, 1754, had a fairly large library for the time. Black learns French and later in life to deal with the Spanish land cases when he's Attorney General of the United States. Judge Black learns Spanish and is at least passably decent at it. Chauncey Forward soon becomes Judge Black's father-in-law. So he's not only his mentor, he's not only his converter to the principles of the Democratic Party, but he's soon also his father-in-law. He has a great respect for Chauncey Forward, and Chauncey is a Christian. And he is one who knows Alexander Campbell, and he soon begins to teach Judge Black about Brother Campbell. We have here a nice likeness of Alexander Campbell. And interestingly enough, both his father and father-in-law die in relatively rapid succession, and they die in their early 40s. And of course, this is an age and an era where people often die at very young ages. This begins to get Judge Black to start thinking and questioning, you know, where would he be if he died? And where is he spiritually? So the fact that he's memorized large portions of the Bible, knows it intellectually, he recognizes that's not the same thing as having a personal faith in Jesus Christ as one Savior and being obedient to the principles of the gospel. So what do you do if you're Jeremiah Black? Well, he takes a kind of a novel approach, at least for my way of thinking. In May of 1843, Jeremiah Black loads up his wife Mary and his third child, his 7-month-old son Henry, who had not yet been weaned, and a nurse, and they drive by wagon to Bethany, Virginia. Now, why would you go to Bethany, Virginia? Well, that's the home of Alexander Campbell. And so Jeremiah Black and his young bride spend several weeks studying the Bible with Alexander Campbell. If you can't bring the mountain to Muhammad, Muhammad goes to the mountain, I guess. And so it's quite remarkable that at the end of that visit, Alexander Campbell leads Jeremiah Black to a little stream behind the Campbell mansion and immerses him into Christ. And so for the rest of his life, he is devoted to the principles that he learned at the feet of Alexander Campbell. And when he was asked from this point forward to what church he belonged, he would reply, "To the sect first called Christians at Antioch." He was passionate in his religious belief and in his fervor. And one of the things that you find when he makes his legal arguments is much of the principles of Christianity are a part of what's involved. By 1851, he's elected to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania and soon becomes its Chief Justice. Of his ability as a writer, David Paul Brown remarked in the early 1850s, he said, "The style of Judge Black's composition is unlike any other with which we are acquainted. If we were asked to say what is its chief merit depends, we should answer in the perfect clearness in which he exhibits his thoughts, whether right or wrong, no man can misunderstand him." One of the reasons Judge Black is not a great politician is he never fails to be understood, whether right or wrong. Well, his friendship with Alexander Campbell is going to be a friendship that will last for the rest of Alexander Campbell's life. And it's a very interesting friendship. And when you look at the exchange of letters between the men, you can see how close that friendship is. They spend some time in correspondence. This is a copy of a letter written by Alexander Campbell to Judge Black. And just to go into a little more detail, or at least to share some things from the correspondence to give you some idea as to what it was about, this is what he's writing to Judge Black in 1855. This is Campbell speaking. "Since my debate with now Archbishop Purcell of Cincinnati, I have been more afraid of Jesuitism and the aggressive spirit than ever before. The tree of liberty cannot grow in a papal soil or in a papal clime. But as a Christian, I know no man after the flesh. I hate no man, however heterodox, on account of his faith." You know, heterodoxy, orthodoxy. Heterodoxy means no matter how much somebody is basically wrong, would be the way Campbell said it. it, or one preacher once said, orthodoxy is my doxy and heterodoxy is your doxy. So he's basically saying, no matter how much somebody may be wrong, at least as I understand the scriptures. And Campbell goes on and says, I have known some honorable Romanists in whom the law of humanity triumphed over the law of its hierarchy. In our wide space community as a church, we have almost an equal number of Whigs, Democrats, and of know-nothings a goodly number. But as the Christian kingdom is with me paramount, I have not hitherto and intend not hereafter to know or not to know any man according to the flesh. Indeed, this has always been my creed and my course. I enter not into their questions, theories, or debates, and finding in Christianity and its author, the great King of Kings, enough to occupy and interest my whole energies, I unreservedly devote them all to him, the few years or days that he may employ me in his vineyard. So Campbell is basically saying, I've got friends in all the political parties. Although, on the other hand, in his correspondence with Judge Black, he's asking the good judge to help him maintain his job as the postmaster of Bethany, Virginia. So he's not above asking his political friends for favors, but he's trying to stay out of the fray as much as he reasonably can. Judge Black's career as a judge on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court lasts until 1856, when James Buchanan is elected President of the United States. A lot of us aren't as familiar with James Buchanan as a lot of other presidents, but he's the president that comes immediately before Abraham Lincoln. And when Buchanan becomes president, he appoints Judge Jeremiah Black Attorney General of the United States. And he does this without consulting the judge. So he appoints him, and then he writes him and says, I hope you'll come. I hope you'll take this job. So he feels like he's got to do that, and so he is soon in the cabinet of the President of the United States as the Attorney General. He also very quickly becomes perhaps the closest friend that James Buchanan has in a political sense. And in fact, sometimes the friendship between Judge Jeremiah Black and President Buchanan was described as the friendship similar to that of David and Jonathan. That's how close the men become. Judge Black also has a skill that a lot of the other cabinet members don't have, which is he can write a good English sentence. And so an awful lot of what is written is drafted first by Judge Jeremiah Black, even for other members of the cabinet. And so while he is in the cabinet of the President of the United States, he extends an invitation to Alexander Campbell to come and visit the White House. And so in 1857, December of 1857, just 2 days after the college burns, by the way, the main building of the college burned on the night of December 10th, 1857, but just 2 days after that, Campbell, his wife Selina, their 2 daughters, Virginia and Decima, get on a zigzag railroad, which is interesting to me, the early days of railroading. They got on a temporary zigzag railway. And Selina said, the immense tunnel having fallen in, they put on an extra engine, turned the seats backwards and forwards, and Selina says it was a fearful time. The night was dark and solemn. The lights seen below looked far off, like tapers. Nevertheless, the family soon reaches Washington, D.C., and on December 22nd, Campbell preached in the Baptist Meeting House on the great themes of the gospel. And President Buchanan attended, as well as some of the cabinet, including Judge Jeremiah Black, with whom, of course, the Campbell family stayed during their time in what was then called Washington City. Many members of Congress also attended. After Campbell's sermon, one person remarked, "Was that not a roaring sermon?" 2 days later, on the evening of December 24th, the family visited President Buchanan in the White House. President Buchanan was, quote, very courteous and entered into quite a conversation with Mr. Campbell. Pendleton, who was with the family, described it as a free and animated conversation of two venerable patriarchs. To be a fly on the wall or to know more about the details of what they talked about. W.K. Pendleton added, I was charmed by the loveliness of manner and suavity of deportment of Miss Harriet Lane, the president's niece. You might recall, President Buchanan is the only president that never married. In Campbell's personal friend, the gifted cabinet minister, W.K. Pendleton wrote, Judge Black, Sure we are that President Buchanan has, quote, at least one large-minded and most competent counselor to whom, not alone in the department over which he presides, but in every question involving the national interest or honor, he can look with confidence and safety for advice. And that's from the Millennial Harbinger of April 1858. You know, interestingly, if you read Campbell's biography by Robert Richardson, the total amount of the biography that deals with the presidential visit is a little less than one full paragraph. So they looked at things rather differently than we do. The fullest account you're going to find in the Millennial Harbinger. So here's a close friendship between two very interesting people. And Judge Black's friendship with Alexander Campbell really influences his entire life. Campbell passes away, as we know, in 1866. And when he passes away, there's a big fight over the will. And in this battle over the will, Selina Campbell employs two men we know well, Judge Jeremiah Black and James A. Garfield, to come and represent her side. And essentially what happened was that the children of, or I should say the grandchildren of the first wife, end up with a relatively small part of the estate. The bulk of the estate goes to Selina's children. And so the grandchildren fight the will. Judge Black writes the brief and attends the first day of the trial. The whole argument of this case goes on for 10 days, which seems like a remarkable amount of time to us, but we've got to remember Alexander Campbell is one of the wealthiest men in the state of West Virginia. And so Judge Black is there for day one, and after that time, James A. Garfield takes Black's brief and pursues the case to a successful conclusion. In 1875, there was a dedication of an Italian marble bust, and I'm not sure whether the bust is represented in the photograph of this on the screen or not, but it kind of conveys the idea. And here was his eulogy, Judge Black's eulogy of Alexander Campbell in 1875 when this bust was dedicated. Judge Black said this about Campbell. As a great preacher, he will be remembered with unqualified admiration by all who had the good fortune to hear him in the prime of his life. The interest which he excited in a large congregation can hardly be explained. The first sentence of his discourse drew the audience still as death, and every word was heard with rapt attention to the close. It did not appear to be eloquence. It was not the enticing words of man's wisdom. The arts of the orator seemed to be inconsistent with the grand simplicity of his character. It was logic, explanation, and argument so clear that everybody followed it without an effort. And all felt that it was the raising of them to the level of a superior mind. Persuasion set upon his lips, prejudice melted under the easy flow of his elocution. The clinching fact was always in its proper place, and the fine poetic illustration was ever at hand to shed its light over the theme. Well, it gives you some idea of Judge Black's eloquence when it came to speaking. And of course, Black ends up in great demand as a public speaker. So that's a remarkable friendship. And I suppose if we stop there with Judge Black, it would be a remarkable enough story to know that this is a man who had served as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, had served as a judge in other capacities, had served as the Attorney General of the United States, and also in the last 4 months of President Buchanan's administration become Secretary of State. But there is a lot more to Judge Black than that. And I want to share some of that with you. And this gives you an idea of what the good judge looked like at about the time he becomes the Attorney General of the United States. That, by the way, is a wig. He was bald by this time. And here is the cabinet of James Buchanan. You know, one thing we could spend a lot of time on, and if you're interested in this, it's certainly worth pursuing, is what happens in the last 6 months of President Buchanan's administration. You know, as we know, the Union is in the process of dissolving after the election of Abraham Lincoln. And so Judge Black plays a key role. You know, he doesn't believe that the Southern states should be permitted to secede, but he's not going to be in favor of the what he views as the overly aggressive and, frankly, completely unconstitutional action of Abraham Lincoln. He would have looked for a little more of a middle course than we end up with. On the other hand, there are times when President Buchanan seems to be kind of unable to to act decisively. And Judge Black is there every step of the way, wanting, for example, Fort Sumner reinforced and pushing General Winfield Scott, who's unfortunately somewhat in his dotage by this time, to act. And he's behind the scenes in everything that goes on in the latter part of 1860 and the early part of 1861. And I guess we should mention, you know, in passing, Judge Black came within one vote of being appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in fact, there was an opening early in 1860 that President Buchanan delays filling because he believes that the Chief Justice is about to resign. He wants Judge Black to have that role. But by the time Judge Black's name is submitted to Congress, a lot of the southern states have left the Union. They're mostly Democratic states, so those votes are gone. And then some of the votes that are still there have been upset because he's argued aggressive measures on behalf of particularly what's going on in South Carolina. And so he falls one vote short. And he leaves office in 1861 essentially broke. And so he takes a job as the court reporter for the U.S. Supreme Court, which compared to where he had been, he's fallen kind of a long way, but he needed a job. You know, we sometimes know how that is. Sometimes we take jobs we wouldn't ordinarily take because of the necessity of the case. And so for 2 years, he serves as the court reporter for the United States Supreme Court. As the Civil War begins to wear on, though, Judge Black's fortunes begin to change. And one of the great cases that's argued before the U.S. Supreme Court is the case of Ex parte Milligan, a case that I studied in law school but didn't really remember that much about until I began to read this case. Lambton P. Milligan was from my state of Indiana. And Milligan was an attorney in the northern part of the state of Indiana who was considered to be a southern sympathizer. And so on the 5th of October, 1864, Mr. Milligan is arrested at 4 o'clock in the morning by the army. And he's taken out in the middle of the night, and they're told if he says anything, just shoot him. Now, one of the things that's sometimes lost as we have, you know, turned Abraham Lincoln into one of the great American heroes is that he personally, and I believe unconstitutionally, suspended habeas corpus. And military tribunals were gradually expanded until they're everywhere in the North. Lincoln imprisons 39,000 people, not a few of whom hang. And in fact, Milligan was sentenced to death by a military commission. So here he is, dragged out of his bed in the middle of the night, not given any of his rights at all, hauled before a military commission, which, guess what, virtually convicted people 100% of the time and convicted. So this case comes to Judge Black, who's outraged by what's happened. And so he takes the case for free. But it's a political case as much as it's a legal case. What do you do to make sure you win? He believes that the civil rights of all Americans are at stake. And realizing the politics of the situation, what he does is he goes to a young man who's become his friend, who's also a Christian, but who is not a radical Democrat as Judge Black, but he's a radical Republican, and that is James A. Garfield. Garfield is some 23 years younger than Judge Black, and the two men develop one of the most extraordinary friendships in American politics. Many times they find themselves, because of their faith in Christ, on the same side, even though they're from these two very different and conflicting parties. And so Judge Black goes to his friend James Garfield and says, I need you to argue this case with me before the United States Supreme Court. Now, the friendship had begun through Judge Black's son Chauncey, who had been named after his father-in-law. Chauncey had become acquainted with Garfield in 1853 while both were attending the Eclectic Institute in Ohio. And in 1862, Chauncey Black met Garfield on the street in Washington, and he soon introduces him to his father. And here begins this incredible friendship. Garfield, fully devoted as he was to the Democratic or to the Republican Party, nevertheless said to Judge Black, send me the facts in the case. If I can agree with the facts in the case, then I will be happy to try to argue this case with you. So The facts basically were that Milligan and three other men had been charged with the following: conspiracy against the government of the United States, affording aid and comfort to rebels against the government of the United States, inciting resurrection, disloyal practices, and violation of the laws of war. Now keep in mind, these men are all civilians. They're not in the military. And so, with those basic facts before him, and the fact that Garfield himself had in Congress several times tried to resist the growth of the power of these military commissions, Garfield looks at the facts in the case and says to Judge Black, I can argue this case with you. Well, Garfield is not only at that time a member of the United States Congress, he's also got the added benefit of having been a major general in the Union Army. And so this is a huge boost. And Garfield writes his own argument. Now, one of the things Garfield says to Judge Black is, I'm happy to argue the case with you, but I've never argued a case of any sort anywhere in my life before. So think about this. You're going to start arguing your first case, and your first case is going to be one of the most important cases relating to civil rights ever argued. And you're going to do it before the United States Supreme Court, and you're going to do it before with the former Attorney General and Secretary of State of the United States. That's an extraordinary place to begin. And Garfield writes his own argument. Judge Black does not write this brief. Here's how Garfield tells the story of how he ends up arguing this case. He said, here Black came to me. He had seen what I'd said in Congress, and he asked if I was willing to say it in argument in the Supreme Court. Well, I said, it depends on your case altogether. He sent me the facts in the case, the record. I read it over. I said, I believe in that doctrine. He said, young man, you know it is a perilous thing for a young Republican in Congress to say that, and I don't want you to injure yourself. Said I, it don't make any difference. I believe in English liberty and English law. But, said I, Mr. Black, I am not a practitioner before the Supreme Court, and I never tried a case in my life anywhere. Said he, how long ago were you admitted to the bar? Just about 6 years ago. That will do, he said. I had been admitted to the Supreme Court of my state enough years under the rules to be admitted to the Supreme Court. And so Judge Black quickly takes care of that. Here's a part of Garfield's argument in front of the Supreme Court. He spoke for 2 hours, so we're going to simply hit a couple of highlights. But here's part of what he says. This is Garfield arguing before the United States Supreme Court. He says, in Texas, Mississippi, Virginia, and other insurgent states, by order of the rebel president, he won't even say the name of Jefferson Davis, the writ of habeas corpus was suspended. Martial law was declared. The provost marshals were appointed to exercise military authority. But when civilians arrested by military authority petitioned for release by writ of habeas corpus, in every case save one, the writ was granted. It was declared that there could be no suspension of the writ or declaration of martial law by the executive or by any other than the supreme legislative authority. So one of his arguments is, we've just fought the rebels, and Garfield hates the rebels as much as anybody. But he says, you know what? In the South, they could not suspend habeas corpus. So part of his argument is, this is kind of embarrassing. You know, here we are in the North, we're claiming we're fighting for liberty, and yet we have suspended habeas corpus. And Garfield goes on and talks about the fact that the courts were open in Indiana. It's not that there were no civil courts open in Indiana during this military trial. In fact, the trial takes place right next to where the civil courts are meeting. And he said, furthermore, this was a state that had never been disturbed by the rebellion. The military commission on the 10th day of its session withdrew from the room where it had been sitting, that the circuit court of the United States might hold its regular term in its own chamber. Seeing this is absurd, to have a military commission in the state of Indiana made no sense. He said, this military commission sat at a place 200 miles beyond the sound of a hostile gun in a state that never felt the touch of martial law and that had never been defiled by the tread of a hostile rebel foot, except on a remote border and then but for a day. That state, with all of its laws and courts, with all of its securities of personal rights and privileges, is declared by the opposing counsel to have been completely and absolutely under the control of martial law. That not only the Constitution and laws of Indiana, but the Constitution and laws of the United States were wholly suspended. That's what happened in the North, by and large. wholly suspended, so that no writ, injunction, prohibition, or mandate of any district court or court of the United States, or even this august tribunal, referring to the Supreme Court, was of any binding force or authority whatever, except by the permission and at the pleasure of a military commander. So Garfield leads off and argues quite passionately that this is basically a travesty, and there's no reason for it. There is no military emergency in Indiana. The civil courts are open. Judge Black goes on and makes his argument. And in his argument, which he makes with even more passion than Garfield, here's at least a part of what he says. He says, between the officers who have a power like this and the people who are liable to become its victims, there can be no relation except that of master and slave. He's saying, if this is the way things are going to be and there are no rights under English common law, here's the relationship you've got. We're reduced to the relationship of a master and slave. The master may be kind and the slave may be contented in his bondage, but the many who can take your life or restrain your liberty or despoil you of your property at his discretion, either with his own hands or by means of a hired overseer, he owns you and he can force you to serve him. All you are and all you have, including your wives and your children, are his property. If my learned and very good friend, the Attorney General, had this right of domination over me, I should not be very much frightened, for I should expect him to use it as moderately as any man in all the world. But still, I should feel the necessity of being very discreet. He might change in a short time. The thirst for blood is an appetite which grows by what it feeds upon. We cannot know him by his present appearances. Robespierre resigned a county judgeship in early life. Robespierre becomes the master of the guillotine in the French Revolution, having thousands executed. Robespierre resigned a country judgeship in early life because he was too tender-hearted to pronounce the sentence of death upon a convicted criminal. Caligula passed for a most amiable young gentleman before he was clothed with the imperial purple, and for about 8 months afterward. It was Trajan, I think, who said that absolute power would convert any man into a wild beast. Whatever was the original benevolence of his nature, if you decide that the Attorney General holds in his own hands or shares with others the power of life or death over us, I mean to be very cautious in my intercourse with him. And I warn you, the judge whom I am now addressing, to do likewise. Trust not the gentleness and kindness which have always marked his behavior heretofore. Keep your distance. Be careful how you approach him, for you know not at what moment or by what trifle you may rouse the sleeping tiger. Remember the injunction of Scripture. Go not near to the man who hath the power to kill, and if thou come unto him, see that thou make no fault, lest he take away thy life presently, for thou goest among snares and walkest upon the battlements of the city. And on he goes. The right of the executive government to kill and imprison citizens for political offenses has not been practically claimed in this country, except in cases where commissioned officers of the army were the instruments used. Why should it be confined to them? Why not naval officers? Why not the common soldier? And on he goes in his argument. Here's how he concludes, and there's much more that we could say, and it's a great argument. It's certainly worthy of reading. He also spoke for 2 hours. But here is how he concludes. You cannot help but see that military commissions, if suffered to go on, will be used for the most pernicious purposes. I have criticized none of their past proceedings, not made any allusion to their history in the last 5 years, which had been awful. But what can be the meaning of this effort to maintain them among us? This is 1866. The Civil War is over. Certainly not to punish actual guilt. All the ends of true justice are attained by the prompt, speedy, impartial trial which the courts are bound to give. Is there any danger that crime will be winked upon by the judges? Does anybody pretend that courts or juries have less ability to decide upon the facts and law than the men who sit in military tribunals? The counsel in this case will not insult you by even hinting such an opinion. What righteous or just purpose then can they serve? None whatever. But while they are utterly powerless to do even a shadow of good, they will be omnipotent to trample upon innocence, to gag the truth, to silence patriotism, and crush the liberties of the country. They will always be organized to convict, and the conviction will follow the accusation as surely as night follows day. The government, of course, will accuse none before such a commission, except those whom it predetermines to ruin and destroy. The accuser can choose the judges and will certainly select those who are known to be the most ignorant and the most unprincipled and the most ready to do whatever they may please, the power which gives them pay, promotion, and plunder. The willing witness can be found as easily as the super serviceable judge, the treacherous spy, the base informer, those loathsome wretches who do their lying by the job will stock such a market with abundant perjury, for the authorities that employ them will be bound to protect as well as reward them. A corrupt and tyrannical government with such an engine at its command will shock the world with the enormity of its crimes. Plied as it may be by the arts of a malignant priesthood and urged on by the madness of a raving crowd, it will be worse than the Popish plot or the French Revolution. It will be a combination of both Farquhar Tinval on the bench and Titus Oates in the witness box. You can save us from this horrible fate. You alone can deliver us from the body of death. To that fearful extent is the destiny of this nation in your hands. Judge Jeremiah Black before the United States Supreme Court, ex parte Mulligan. Well, needless to say, the Supreme Court unanimously rules for Judge Black and James Garfield. And Garfield's career as a lawyer is somewhat made. Garfield goes on, represents a number of famous clients. Judge Black several times tries to get James Garfield to go into the practice of law with him. That never quite happens, but they do combine together on several other important cases. And I guess I might add a postscript to Mulligan. The Supreme Court orders him released, as well as the others who had been sentenced to hang, by the way. And of course, if you're an attorney, you know this is the perfect case for false arrest. And so the attorney Mulligan brings that case in the Indiana courts, and the federal government selects another attorney named Benjamin Harrison to defend the government. And he does so fairly successfully. He can't really win the case on the facts. The case is won by Mulligan, but the jury only awards a verdict of $5. And so that was the end of Brother Mulligan. Well, we could say, I think, a good deal more about Judge Black and his friendship with James Garfield shown here. But a few more things, I guess, about Brother Black personally, as I'm coming to the end of my time. Judge Black goes on from the ex parte Mulligan case, becomes one of the leading lawyers in the country. Everybody wants Judge Black to try their cases. Among the people that he represents, at least at one point in time or another, are Andrew Johnson during his impeachment, Samuel Tilden, who won the election of president in 1876, only to have it basically stolen by fraud, is represented by Judge Black. Judge Black is involved in a number of California land cases. And in one case, he wins a verdict and is paid $180,000 as his fee. And that fee stood for some 30 years as the highest fee ever paid to any attorney. So he becomes a very wealthy person as a result of his skills as a lawyer. Interestingly, he never had his fee agreements ever put in writing. If people stiffed him on the fee, didn't pay him at all, or paid him some reduced amount, he just let it go. He believed it wasn't worth fighting about. And so, because he is so famous, he tries cases all over the United States. And in 1869, he's traveling on train south of Louisville, Kentucky. And in this train, he's sitting with his arm in the windowsill. And a cargo train, freight train, coming the other direction, has something sticking out that catches the judge's hand and smashes the hand and arm right into the windowsill. So the freight car tore through the passenger train. He's the only person seriously injured. It caught the palm of his right hand and dragged it backward against the window casing. His arm was broken in seven places between the wrist and the elbow. His elbow joint was crushed, and most of the bones in his fingers and hand were broken. The doctors, of course, wanted to amputate the arm, but he refused to allow it. He spent 7 weeks in the hospital, finally leaving on the 25th of July, 1869. However, his arm was, for all practical purposes, useless the rest of his life. Well, he's right-handed, and this is a world before computers or typewriters or anything else. So how did you do your work as a lawyer? You wrote it by longhand. And what you see here is Judge Black, and this is his signature. The first one is with his right hand. The second is with his left. In very quick order, Judge Black teaches himself to shave, to write, to do everything he needs to do with his left hand instead of with his right. So the top exemplar is his handwriting before his arm is crushed. The bottom is after his hand is crushed with his left hand. Within 3 months of the accident, he's right back at work, chugging along. So, you know, you can thank God you live in the age in which you live. Somebody's once said that we've all won the cosmic lottery to be in a world where you can have modern dentistry and modern medicine. He did not live in that kind of world. He was one tough man. I'll close with just a couple of things because I've got about 2 minutes left. Judge Black champions Christianity and has a written debate with Ingersoll, the great opponent of Christianity. That's very much near the end of his life. And in addition to those sorts of things, he continues to the very end of his life really as a very devout Christian. And so we'll close with this eulogy, which is from his son, Chassie. And here is what he said. It will be unnecessary to inform the reader of the following pages that Jeremiah S. Black was a devout Christian. Fearing nothing else in this world, he went always and humbly in the fear of God. His whole mind and being were saturated with the morality of the Testament of Christ, which, he said, was filled with all forms of moral beauty and radiant with miracles of light. He was baptized in 1843 by Alexander Campbell, whose eulogy he pronounced upon the unveiling of his statue at Bethany, West Virginia. It's a pretty good eulogy. If you can say that about me when I'm gone from this life, I will have done all right. Thank you very much for your kind attention. I do have a chronology of Brother Black's life. So if you're interested in, we'll leave that up front. And also, there's some books which I recovered from a home in Indiana by Daniel Austin Sommer. They're all over 65 years old. Not necessarily endorsing the contents of the book, but they're all very interesting things historically. You're certainly welcome to help yourself to those books if you have an interest in that part of history. Thank you so much for coming, and thanks for your attention.